Open the House Committee on Human Services today, February 23rd, 2009, and open up public hearings on 2449, 2450, and 2451. So, Kaylee, you want to read us about those bills?
House Bill 2449 expands the language to require an investigation when there is certainty that an injury is the result of abuse. It expands the definition of an evaluating official and links it to a statutory definition, allows the Department of Justice to require by rule the submission of information and funding applications for regional assessment centers, and allows the Department of Justice to provide compensation for medical examinations required under Carley's Law. House Bill 2450 establishes a tax credit for physicians, physician's assistants, or nurse practitioners who agree to perform the medical assessments required by Carley's Law, and sets a maximum for the amount of the credit and the number of the individuals statewide who are eligible to receive the credit. And 2451 creates two designated medical professional positions within the Department of Justice to provide the child abuse medical assessments and lays out the requirements for those positions.
Thank you very much. Representative Gelser.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Gelser, representative from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. I have three bills before you today, two of which I hope will move. The third, I think that we're taking care of in another way, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But all of these bills are the product of some work that many of us shared in together last session, which was the passage of a bill called Carley's Law. For those of you who weren't here, a brief overview of that bill. I had started working on this issue after a child in my district, her name was Carly Sheehan. She was not quite 3 years old when she was systemically tortured and brutally murdered by the boyfriend of her mother. And while that in itself is tragic, it's always tragic to learn about circumstances like that, what's even more tragic is that the Department of Human Services had been called on child welfare checks and to go and investigate allegations of abuse prior to her murder, and had unfounded, had marked those cases as unfounded for abuse. And when all of this was over, it turned out that this child had in fact been systemically tortured over the course of the last 9 to 10 months of her life. What we found during the prosecution of the murder of this case, which was prosecuted in Benton County, was that there were some steps along the way where warning signs were missed. In particular, the child had never seen a physician that was trained to understand child abuse injuries, and therefore the perpetrator of this crime started and furthered the myth that this child was injuring herself, which was completely impossible, and any child abuse physician would be able to tell you that. The other issue was that photographs had been taken of this child that showed her hair all torn out, large bruises all over her body, but those photographs were lost and never shared with anyone on the child multidisciplinary team or with a physician who, had they seen those photos, also would have recognized in December, this was about 6 months before her death, that this child was the victim of serious abuse. And at this time, the father of the child was calling local law enforcement, the DHS agency, everyone begging for assistance to find out what was happening with his child. So we passed this bill last session that tried to address a couple of those pieces. The first was that it established some protocols for the disposition of photographs and made sure that whenever there were suspicious physical injuries, that photographs would be taken of these injuries and shared with child abuse knowledgeable physicians and the county multidisciplinary team. It also required that a child with suspicious physical injuries that was the subject of a child abuse investigation would either be seen by a child abuse trained physician or another physician who would consult with them within 48 hours of discovering that injury. And the bill did some other things, but a promise that I made at that time, it was a pretty big policy change, was that we would continue to touch base with the Department of Justice, the Department of Human Services, the assessment centers, and local governments over the course of the first biennium of implementation to find out what the challenges were so that we could come back in this session and try to address some of those things. And these bills are the result of keeping that promise. The first bill, House Bill 2449, is just a couple of technical fixes. There is a Crime Victims Fund that has been difficult to access to pay for these assessments in the rare case that the allegations for abuse are not substantiated. So this makes certain that the exams are paid for. The other thing that it clarifies, we were very, very careful to come up with a definition of what a suspicious physical injury was. We wanted kids who were potentially in danger to get to a physician, but we did not want to flood DHS and local law enforcement and local medical professionals with a string of kids who'd fallen off their bicycles and skinned their knee. So if you look on page one of House Bill 2449, you'll see that list of what a suspicious physical injury is. And these are pretty significant things: burns or scalds, broken bones, the lost the ability to walk or move normally, multiple fractures, these kinds of things. The problem that we've had in the implementation is that in some parts of the state, the word suspicious has caused some confusion. And so the question has been, if the investigator is absolutely confident or nearly confident that the injuries are related to abuse, does the child still need medical attention? And this bill clarifies that, yes, if the child has these injuries, even if you're certain that it was abuse, it still fits the definition of suspicious physical injury under this bill, and the child still needs the photographs taken in the assessment. This is very important for successful prosecution of these cases, not to mention the health and well-being of an injured child. So that is House Bill 2449. Are there questions on that bill before moving on to the next one?
No question, just a comment, and thank you so much for doing this, Sarah. This is a long time coming, the whole series, starting last time.
Thank you. It's been a good bill to work on, and many members of my community and of our community of Oregon really worked on pulling this together last session. It's got lots of mothers and fathers. So House Bill 2450, one of the challenges that we've seen in the implementation of Carly's Law, the way that it was designed, it created this idea of a designated medical professional. And this was a person that would be willing to and able to do these assessments. And the way that we had envisioned it, each county multidisciplinary team would go out and find local physicians or nurse practitioners or physician's assistants that were willing and able to provide these exams. It hasn't worked out that way. In a lot of places, there hasn't actually been a significant search and outreach to bring people in, but people are very busy, and there isn't a lot of a benefit to a person to sign up and do this work. This is really painstaking, heartbreaking work, and it's very difficult to find people that are willing to do this work and see firsthand the horrors that some of these children are experiencing. The impact of that has been that the child abuse assessment centers, the regional centers around the state, have seen a substantial increase in the number of cases that are coming in regards to physical abuse. And what they have said to me is, we don't want to get rid of the law because that tells us we weren't picking these kids up before, that's important, but we have to find a way to help address this capacity issue. It's not as easy as just adding additional physicians to these assessment centers either, because you could go weeks without having a Carly exam, and then you might have four in 1 week. So you really need something to address that uneven caseload. So what this bill would do is allow a tax credit of up to $5,000 to local individuals who meet that qualification of a designated medical provider, and that includes physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners. And we would give them a tax credit of up to $5,000 a year if they agreed to provide between 8 and 12 of these exams over the course of a year. If they couldn't provide that minimum of 8 because there weren't that number of exams to do, we're not going to punish them for that, and they would get the prorated amount of that. We've capped, in order to manage the expense, we've capped the number of these that would be eligible across the state to 40, which would allow one in each county plus a couple of more in different places. And there is an error on the first page of the bill on line 26 where it says the Department of Human Services shall establish by rule basically who gets to take the credit. That would actually be determined by the multidisciplinary teams who have the responsibility of identifying their designated medical providers. One of the things that's not in this bill that's important for you to know is that in my work over the course of the last year speaking with nonprofit partners, I do believe that it is going to be possible. There is a nonprofit organization that is interested and has indicated their willingness to pay the expenses of these potential providers to attend training, to become trained to provide these exams, including not only the expenses but also stipends to participate in doing that. And there is another nonprofit organization that has indicated their willingness to provide that training. So the benefit of these tax credits would be to help, particularly in areas where there isn't easy access to an assessment center, or it might be a long drive to an emergency room. But it also will increase the prevention and the resource within the community, because we'll be able to bring this training by providing an incentive for people to step up and get that training. The last, any questions on that one before I move on to the next one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gelser, you danced all around my question, but you came close. So just so that I kind of have an idea of how it works, in some areas there are assessment centers. In those and in areas where they're not, does DHS contract with a provider or something for these assessment services when they're needed, or an emergency room, or how are these people identified? I mean, I know the multidisciplinary team, but how are they is there one per community or whatever?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman. That's a very good question. One of the things that's interesting about this area is it actually flows through the Department of Justice instead of the Department of Human Services. And under the provisions of the bill, each multidisciplinary team would have identified one or more medical professionals, and again, it's that broad definition of medical professionals that they have deemed appropriate to do these exams. The bill, and there isn't one in every community. There isn't easy access, and that's been one of the challenges. One of the off-ramps that was in the bill, recognizing that would happen, is that if one of these people isn't available, the child should be seen by any physician, and then that physician can consult by telephone, by internet, through telemedicine with someone that does have training in that area. And the way that this has worked is that photographs have been sent to the assessment centers from more rural parts of the state, or there has been guidance that's been given over the telephone about things to look for in an exam. Where it hasn't worked as well is that sometimes the choice has been to simply take a child to an emergency room. In some parts of the state that works well. In other parts of the state it does not. I did talk with a district attorney in a rural part of the state, and their emergency room is staffed by traveling ER docs. It's not always the same person. And she described an event. She was frustrated with the level of care and service that her victims were getting when they went. And she described a case where there was a child, an elementary school-aged child, that went to school and disclosed that she had been raped that morning. And so they took her immediately to the emergency room for a rape kit. And the physician that was on duty in that emergency room that day said, oh, no, that's disgusting. We don't do rape kits on 9-year-old girls, even though that was the evidence she had the evidence. So they were able to find another pediatrician across the street who on the telephone consulted with CARES Northwest and via telephone kind of talked her through that exam. So the idea is to know who those resources are in the community. As far frustrating as that is on so many levels, if you can imagine being the 9-year-old girl who's terrified and has been courageous enough to disclose that this has happened to her and to see this disarray around her as the adults try to respond. I don't pretend that this will solve everything, but hopefully this is an affordable step moving forward that will give local communities some more tools to be able to compassionately and quickly respond and to take some of that pressure off of the assessment centers. And it would also allow them to triage a little bit where you could take more what appear to be more minor cases of abuse to these tax-credited individuals that are out there and save the more complex cases for the assessment centers. Because really, the assessment centers are the only places that are very well equipped to do sex abuse evaluations for kids.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and it brought up another one, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So if the 9-year-old little girl, for example, if she tells her school teacher, and then where would the school teacher take the little girl? It's kind of like in education, you know, we're working through 2062 about the reporting, and I'm just kind of curious where this 9-year-old goes over the next hour after she's reported to, say, her teacher.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I believe that would follow through the mandatory reporting process that we all watched the video about together. And so that teacher is a mandatory reporter. I would assume, I don't know the details of that hour for this child, but I assume the child
probably
would be taken to a
DHS
safe place,
and
the call would be made either to DHS or law enforcement, and there's that cross-reporting. I believe there are folks here from the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services that can maybe answer that question in a little bit for you with more detail.
Madam Chair. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Gelser. I'm actually semi-answering Representative Huffman's question a little bit, too, and I appreciate you bringing this proposal forward, because partly what spurred it, I believe, is in follow-up to the passage of Carley's Law, the House Rural Policy Committee happened to be on a road trip, if you will, to Eastern Oregon, talking about a whole variety of issues that relate to rural issues. And this was one of the things that we heard in one of the counties along the way, was the difficulty of accessing the adequate number of, or any provider to meet the specifications of Carley's Law. And in some cases in that particular county, they were then transporting the child with suspected abuse quite a distance to a center. And so this, Representative Gelser, am I correct, is part of the effort to try to bring some impetus behind making more providers, bringing more providers into it. And the difficulty is not just a lack of willingness, but very few providers in many of our rural areas, and individuals whose practices are so full that they don't feel that they can commit to being tied up in a fairly lengthy kind of examination process. Is that a fair assessment of this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, that is a fair assessment of this bill and the next one that I'll talk about in a minute that addresses some of those. I think it's also a reflection of a lesson learned. As freshman legislators, we all learn a lot of lessons. I certainly did. And there's a lot of things I would do differently. On this bill, one of the things, if I could go back in time and do differently, I would not have put an emergency clause on the bill. The effect of this bill was that it immediately went into effect upon passage. So on June 26th, 2007, these requirements were not in place, and on June 27th, 2007, they were. This represented an enormous change in practice. It was very scary, I think, for a lot of people that were out there. And at the time of that rural tour, I think that there were counties that were in the position of having to comply with a law that they didn't yet fully understand and hadn't yet been trained on. So I think that initially there was a lot of fear and resistance because those off-ramps that were in there weren't clear, and people saw the must-see a designated medical provider within 48 hours, and there wasn't yet that clarity that you could do some consultation or some other things. So I regret that it came to be in that place, and I think it was reflected by the communications. This bill, Carley's Law, is something that I continue to get regular communication from all over the state about, and it's certainly gone through an evolution. After it passed, I had lots of really mean voicemails in my office and people that were very, very frustrated. And probably within about 6 months of the time that the bill passed, those phone calls started to change, and I started to get phone calls from some of the very people that had been very angry initially, saying, I saw a kid today, and I think I saved them, or we saw this other child and we were able to change what happened to them. Now I understand what this is and how it works. I think having an emergency clause and not allowing adequate time for training really undermined the ability for that to happen in a way that was gentle and helpful to the very heroic people that had to come out and implement this very quickly.
Thank you, Representative. Any last questions? All right.
So the last one is this House Bill 2451, and I am not requesting that this bill move forward to a work session, but I introduced it so that it could kind of put into the legislative record an idea of what it is that we're trying to accomplish, and I think we may be able to accomplish this through another vehicle that I believe is going to come to you later. What this does is addresses that issue that Representative Cowan was just explaining, that even it's not... In some places, it's not so much an issue of nobody's willing to do it. It's just that there aren't enough people to provide it. And sometimes this the instability of the number of kids that may need these exams, it's not as easy as just hiring another person at an assessment center. So the idea is, how can we create some itinerant folks that are available to either go directly to some of these places to go to the kid to provide the services and examinations, or to take on some of the workload of doing the consultations and doing the file reviews. And that was another error in the bill that we didn't recognize, is that the assessment centers, in addition to doing these exams, are also in the position of reviewing a bunch of these files. And although they're compensated for the exams, there's not a compensation mechanism for doing these file reviews when the child has seen a different provider. So the idea is, if we can get some resource to the Department of Justice to be able to provide some of this itinerant fill-in help, it's another way to get at this issue besides the tax credit. And so you'll have another bill that's coming to you. It actually is relating to tobacco products, and it involves a change in the taxing mechanism for moist snuff. It's a bill that I've introduced at the request actually of U.S. Tobacco that supports this change in taxing mechanism for tobacco products, and it raises a little bit of revenue, most of which in that bill would go, as it always does, to health care programs, but a piece of it would come off the top and go to the Department of Justice to support these types of itinerant and flexible services that are needed to ensure these exams. And then I wanted to just close. I was sorting through all of these Carley's Law things that come into my mailbox, and I was looking at the summer 2008 Klamath Lake County Assessment Center. So it's the CARES from Klamath and Lake County, a very rural part of the state. And there's this article in here written by a CARES lead child interviewer, and she says, "Since Carley's Law implementation, there have been two cases which have remained in the forefront of my mind as an illustration of how this law helps children." And remember, this would have been written not quite 12 months after the bill went into effect. The first case was that of a 6-year-old female. She was seen under Carley's Law due to suspected physical abuse. As part of the physical examination, she had an anogenital examination. This examination found evidence that she had been sexually abused. Without the implementation of Carley's Law, the child would never have been seen at CARES, and she would have had ongoing contact with her perpetrator. The second case was that of a 2-year-old male. The child was seen for a slap mark to his face under Carley's Law. This case would not necessarily have been seen at CARES prior to the implementation of Carley's Law. Due to the thoroughness of the medical examiner, x-rays were ordered and healing fractures were found as a result. Clearly, the effect of Carley's Law has been in the best interest of children, not only in our community, but also statewide. And those are similar to the kinds of stories and phone calls and emails I've received from across the state about the impact that this has had on very vulnerable children that are experiencing difficult things. The implementation of the bill hasn't been easy, and like anything, it isn't perfect. But these bills, I think, will help to move us in the direction of doing this better and better protecting these kids. And I really hope that you'll consider forwarding 49 onto the floor and 50 onto revenue and helping me with that moist snuff bill so that we can make sure that we're able to help more of these children.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. You've done a phenomenal job with all of these. Any questions? All right, thank you.
And Madam Chair, will you excuse me if I don't stay for the rest of the hearing and go back to beer taxes?
No.
Please?
All right, thank you. Okay, and then we will, if you have any desire to speak on these bills, please do sign up and come. Keely will be bringing that list up for us.
This is listen. She's just at all the hearings that are going on now. I think in the revenue. I would imagine.
Thank you. So, of course, you can speak on all of the bills if you so desire. Stacey Ayers and Cynthia Stinson. I saw some heads nodding as Representative Gelser was giving her testimony. Go right ahead.
Chair, may members of the committee, my name is Stacey Ayers, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding or in support of House Bill 2449. Specifically, what I'd like to talk about today is Section 1, Sub 2 of House Bill 2449. It provide some clarification to the existing Oregon statute, which is known as Carley's Law, and was passed last session, 419B023 sub 2, has some, a little bit, currently has a little bit of confusing language, and I think people, I think that Representative Gelser talked about that, talks about suspicious, when there's reasonable suspicion to believe, and that's led to some confusion for folks in the field who are doing these investigations. And essentially what this bill does, House Bill 2449 does, is clarify that. And in fact, the language is pretty specific. It says, even if you know, you still need to proceed. And that's kind of the thing that people have been struggling with is, well, once we know it, it's not suspicious anymore. So do we need to still go along and do the medical evaluations? And yes, the answer is yes. And I think that even though that wasn't clear, that's the information we were trying to get out to anybody to begin with. So this change in House Bill 2449 clarifies that an injury being investigated for child abuse that falls under this procedures is intended to be covered under Carley's Law. And really, that's about the only thing that I'm going to testify to in regards to that bill. The other parts of it are going to be Ms. Denson will speak to from DOJ. And I'd just like to say that I hope the committee will consider a due pass recommendation. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victims Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on House Bill 2449 and 2450. You have to excuse me. I'm fighting a rather persistent cough. I hope I can get through this without coughing at you. House Bill 2449, as you've already heard from Representative Gelser and Mr. Ayers, makes some changes to Carley's Law. I wanted to speak specifically to the pieces that affect the Department of Justice. And the first and most directly related to Carley's Law is a provision that allows us to pay for those medical assessments if a child is presented to, let's say, an emergency room and not a child abuse assessment center and receives really only a medical exam. The child abuse assessment statutes under the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention statutes have language that explain what a medical assessment is that includes not only a medical exam but an interview and those kind of wraparound services. The CAMI statute was intended to make sure that children weren't interviewed multiple times and try to reduce the trauma that they go to a child-friendly facility. And Carley's Law, of course, makes those urgent physical cases, physical abuse cases, they need to be seen right away. And the child abuse assessment centers are most often seeing non-acute child sex abuse cases. So this has been a kind of a change in shift in paradigm for them. But there are times when it's 5 o'clock on a Friday night, and a child cannot go to an assessment center. They're not open 24/7, and needs to go to an emergency room or a physician's office. And so they would only receive that medical exam, that physical medical exam. So currently, our office cannot reimburse for those exams if after the exam there is not a finding of abuse. We do have a special pot of money that we can pay for when a child goes to an assessment center and has that full assessment interview and wraparound services. If there's no finding of abuse, no disclosure, we can pay for those in an assessment center. There's this gap now because of Carley's Law and kids going to their general practitioners or pediatricians or emergency rooms when they say there's no abuse. Then sometimes the parents are going home with that bill. And we don't anticipate this happening very often, but as you can imagine, when it does happen, here you have a parents or guardian of a child. They're approached by DHS or law enforcement, essentially with accusations of abuse. they're told they need to have their child go for a medical exam. Maybe they go to an emergency room, and if you're in Salem, you might sit for a few hours if it's a non-life-threatening injury. And at the end of it, they say, your child wasn't abused. Thank you very much. Here's your bill. And that doesn't go over very well, as you can imagine, with parents. So this change is trying to fill that gap. Again, we don't anticipate that it will have a large fiscal impact. We don't anticipate that it will affect that many parents, but the parents that it does affect, it will be very important for them to be able to have the hospital bill us for that medical exam. The other piece that affects the Department of Justice directly is really a cleanup in our CAMI statute, and we collaborated with Representative Gelser on this bill. We had our own bill that had the compensation piece and then this cleanup in it, and then as we were working with her, we moved them all into one bill under 2449. So this piece actually is a cleanup of the statutes that govern the grants that we make for regional assessment centers. And those centers, right now there are five of them. They offer technical assistance and training to the 19 child advocacy centers throughout the state. And right now there is language in statute that that spells out just what they have to do for an application for funding. And it was created when the CAMI statute was originally created, and there wasn't really a whole program around it. We've discovered that by statute now we're asking those assessment centers, when they make application, for information that's not really relevant to the services they're providing, which, as you can imagine, is kind of a time waster for those assessment centers. So we're merely asking to remove that very prescriptive language and allow us to make the requirements in rule or part of our grant application so it can be more relevant and they don't have to waste time answering questions that we're not really going to address in our funding. So those are really the two pieces that I wanted to address today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Cynthia. Any questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cynthia, curiosity question on reimbursement. And let's say that a child is taken in by her parents for an exam, and they have health insurance. And so they submit this, you know, under their policy. Is there anything to prevent the insurance company from submitting a bill to Department of Justice for reimbursement for that, since Department of Justice would have a mechanism set up to pay for those types of things?
Mm-hmm. Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, that's a good question. Our program, our Crime Victims Compensation Program, requires that we're the payer of last resort, and so they would have to use their insurance first. So any bill that we would receive directly from the hospital, if we knew that there was insurance involved, we would look for an explanation of benefits, either paying for part of that or denying it before we would ever consider paying. So we are the payer of last resort.
Thanks.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you both very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on? Yes.
I'm sorry. I wanted to speak to 2450 also,
oh,
if I might.
Oh, sorry. Sure.
That's okay. Excuse me for not being clear. I just wanted to, as kind of a technical expert on 2450, reiterate what Representative Gelser said about communities having a difficult time really accessing adequate physician services at all for the common cold or ongoing care, much less having access to physicians for medical exams. And we are working very diligently with DHS and our community partners in the nonprofit and child advocacy world to try to get more training for physicians, and just want to be on the record that we support anything that will give incentive for physicians to be involved in their communities and child abuse issues. It's kind of a bewildering and sometimes frightening area, which I think can be some of that can be dispelled with training and access to the multidisciplinary team and community partners. So if this bill can help with that, we support that.
Thank you so much. Any further questions? Thank you both very much for coming today. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on any of these bills? Okay, I will close the public hearing on 2449, 2450, and 2451, and open up a work session on 2206. Thank you. need Carly.
Carly.
You got Carly on the mic
now. I do.
Now.
I do. Please go ahead.
House Bill 2206 closes a loophole and prevents child care providers whose licenses are denied, suspended, revoked, or voluntarily surrendered in lieu of legal action for continuing to care for children or operate a preschool. It also prevents individuals who are denied, suspended, or removed from the criminal history registry for cause from providing care to children or operating preschool.
Thank you.
And if you have questions, I know Tom Olson and Kathleen Hines are here from the Employment Department.
Great. Could you come up, please? So, colleagues, we heard this bill on the 13th, a couple of weeks ago, and I think there was some interest in the committee to pass this bill. We felt like there was a loophole that we wanted to close. So could you talk a little bit, remind us what this bill does and encourage us to pass it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Olson, Administrator of the Child Care Division, and Kathleen Hines, our Legal and Compliance Officer, is here with me today. 2206 is, for us, an important piece of legislation because currently the way that the law works, Oregon has a considerable amount of license-exempt care, and our licensors are right at the moment, just to sort of cut to the chase, they're put in a position when we take a legal action against a child care provider who is really providing very bad care. We are now in the position of saying your license is suspended. Which of the three children in your care do you want to keep? Because a provider can care for up to three unrelated children without being licensed. So what this bill does is it subjects these folks basically to licensure. If they have had a license and it's taken away, they are still subject to the authority of the Child Care Division. If they continue to provide care for at exempt levels, we can take legal action against them. And that's it in a nutshell. And, of course, we urge you to pass the bill.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Is this for all child care providers or child care providers who are paid for child care by the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, this would be for providers that are licensed and some of which, of course, are paid by the state.
Okay.
The state has a listing system that allows family members, for instance, to care for exempt care, but this pertains specifically to those that are licensed. So it could be paid or not paid.
Okay.
The great majority of these folks would be probably unpaid by the state. They'd be paid only by the parents.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, on the matrix that you and Kathleen had worked on and come up with, I don't see on here a separation between registered and certified. Were we talking?
I think you're talking maybe about 2205.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Another day.
I'd be very happy to meet with you after the session, Representative, and we can talk.
Sounds
about that.
Good. We can clarify some
sure.
of that.
Thank you. Go into our you're subcommittee welcome. Again.
Representative Van Orme, you have further
just
questions?
One more question. So assuming that whatever was committed by the applicant that excludes them from the criminal registry system, that's a lifetime exclusion. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So that there's no ability for them to be redeemed and get back into the fold?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, yes.
Okay.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2206 to the floor to be adopted with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Boone recommends the House Bill 2206 be moved to the floor with be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. Thank you very much. Zach, will you call the roll call? And start from the end of the alphabet instead of the first. Sorry, Representative, but I've always sort of resented it that I was one of the last people being called. But I will be the last as chair. I will be the last one.
He'll accept that. Okay. Yeah, let's make that perfectly clear.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Excuse?
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Excused.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. This motion passes, and House Bill 2206 is adopted, and we'll go to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Thank you, committee. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Good bill.
You want to sign a carrier?
Oh. Representative Tomei, if I may, I'm sitting here, and it has nothing to do with you. You can.
Well, is this about this bill?
No, it is not about this bill.
Okay, then I'm going to suggest that there be a carrier. Who has, among our freshmen, has not had a chance to carry a bill yet in any committee? Nobody has their hand up. Oh, Representative Edelman, would you like to carry this bill?
I'll carry this child care bill, sure.
And Keeley will assist you with that.
Okay.
Okay, so we have a carrier. That's all I need to do.
That's
right?
All you need.
Okay, now Representative Edelman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I have been, the first three bills are very disturbing to me, because I've been in the business of Head Start for a long time, working for a long time with these issues. And I guess the thing that's really bothering me is they've been in the social service field forever, and it hasn't gotten very much attention. But now that we've moved it into the criminal justice system, now we're talking about money. And I just find myself doing a sort of slow burn about that. And the one thing, above all, that really disturbs me, that in spite of all the efforts that we're trying to do on investigation, we still are underpaying foster homes. We still don't have adequate places for these children. And I find myself extremely disturbed about that. And it's finally getting the attention it deserves, but there have been a lot of us in the trenches for a long, long time struggling for recognition of this serious issue, and so it's probably a deep resentment that money follows the criminal justice system, but it doesn't follow the social service system. So having said that, I think I feel better.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman.
You're welcome.
Okay, anything else for the good of the order? All right, thank you very much, committee. I'm glad we passed a very good bill, and we'll be hearing further hearings on Carley's Law, and hopefully we can pass some of those too. With that, unless there's anything for the good of the order, I will close the House Committee on Human Services, and thank you all very much.